Chicago was in deep freeze last week. Planes were being de-iced and some southern states like Georgia were covered in snow. So it was paradoxical to have AAAS sessions on the big thaw. Chris Field is the director of the Carnegie Institution for Science.
One of the things I've learned about coming to AAAS meetings is that the best way to assure a big snowstorm is to have a series on climate change. I can't explain it. But what I would like to do is spend a few minutes talking about the rate of climate change. We know a lot about the prospects for the amount, but relatively little about the rate. And one of the things we can do, especially in the context of capacity for movements and plants and animals and farmers, is think about how the rate that we have experienced in recent decades and expect to experience in the future compares with past climate changes. As most of you know, the climate change we're anticipating over the 21st century is a global average warming of in the range of 2 to 4C. For midsummer in Chicago, an increase of 2C gives Chicago the same temperatures as approximately Atlanta. An increase of 3C gives Chicago approximately the same temperatures as Miami. An increase of 5C gives Chicago approximately the same temperatures as Houston. Get a sense that these are really big changes. But if we look back in time, we can get an even better sense for the magnitude of the changes. CO2, we have a really good record from Antarctic ice cores. That record goes back 800,000 years. We have never in that record seen CO2 concentrations within 100 ppm of current levels. Based on a large number of proxies, we can go back millions of years. Over the last 25 million years, there may have been as many as three times when atmospheric CO2 was as high as the current level, which is about 400 parts per million. But it's never been as high as 600 parts per million, which is an aggressive target for the future. But let me talk a little bit about the rate. You know, we can think about the rate of climate change in degrees per decade, but if you're an organism or an individual that needs to adapt, the way you really want to think about it is in miles per hour. How fast do you need to move your activities in order to stay in a zone of acceptable climate? If we look around the world at the continued high emissions rate of climate change, we see most of the land area having required rates of species or human movement on the order of a few kilometers per year, in some cases up to more than 20 or 30 kilometers per year. Looking back in time, we know that many plants and animals are able to shift at a few hundred meters per year, hardly ever more than a fraction of a meter. How fast has the climate changed in the past? And that's really the message I want to leave with you. If we look back to the Little Ice Age, we see changes that are on the order of less than a tenth of a degree per decade. If we go back to the last deglaciation 18,000 years ago, again, rates of climate change on the order of a tenth to a few tenths per decade. And if we go back 55 million years to the biggest climate change we know the Earth has ever seen, a massive cooling beginning about 52 million years ago, we still see rates of climate change that are on the order of a few hundredths of a degree per decade. And it's not until we go back 55 million years ago to something called the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum that we see rates of climate change that may even come close within an order of magnitude of the rates that we're almost certain to get over the coming century. We know very little about the ability of plants, animals, and humans to respond to these incredibly rapid rates of climate change.
Well, good afternoon. Very interesting intro there about rates and the need to understand how animals are adapting. So my main message here is that at least in the marine ecosystem, marine mammals are great sentinels of change. We have had a step change in the Arctic. It's now commonly referred to as the new normal. We've lost roughly 75% of multi-year ice. So we're in a situation where we have thin ice, and of that, 50% of the surface area is gone. So essentially since 2007 in the Pacific Arctic region, if you're a marine mammal that requires ice, like a polar bear or a walrus, it's gone. Your platform has left and you have to change. So those ice obligate animals, which I call them sometimes, the walrus have moved to shore because there's no ice platform to sit on anymore and just dive down to the shelf to eat. Some of the polar bears are getting thinner, having to eat on the coast as well, but in some populations, they're doing well. So there's also a regional aspect to this in terms of how the animals are adapting. In the marine ecosystem, we have a lot going on with production. And as top predators, the marine mammals will reflect those changes both by shifts in their distribution and relative abundance, but also by their body condition and health. And so my main message here as a marine ecologist is that we need to bring together the science of marine ecology and marine mammals and that of health. Especially in the Arctic, where people rely on marine mammals. Indigenous people rely on them for sustenance, for food. They also rely on them for cultural identity. And so it's very much a part of their lives, these animals. And knowing what is going on in the body condition and health of the animals is very important for the people that live there. So marine mammals connect people to marine ecosystem change. They connect the people in the Arctic that rely on the animals, but also because people in general care about marine mammals. They care about polar bears, walrus, whales, and that allows us to extend our message. The animals themselves are telling us what's going on in the ecosystem. They're sending that message. We have to get better at interpreting it and bringing together the science of marine mammal health and marine mammal ecology.
Ice is a significant ecological barrier, and I'm a molecular parasitologist, and I'm interested in the spread and transmission and exposure of pathogens, how they essentially move into new areas. And with climate change, which we now realize and appreciate is quite real, this is an unprecedented opportunity for pathogens to shift into new environments and cause new diseases, because with increased climate change, with increased temperatures in the Arctic, pathogens can persist and gain access to new and susceptible hosts. A parasite that we know is common, it commonly infects us and, in fact, all warm-blooded vertebrates on the planet, and it's called Toxoplasma. It's a eukaryotic protozoan parasite that's common in the brain and spinal fluids. It causes an encephalitic-type disease. So this common parasite in the lower 48 is now emerging in the Arctic, and we found it for the first time in population of Western Arctic beluga in the Beaufort Sea. And that actually has important public health message, because this is a hunter-harvested animal that is part of the traditional Inuit diet. The second tale, I guess, is of a new parasite, an Arctic parasite, that has emerged to cause mass mortality events in gray seals and other endangered marine mammal species south of the Arctic polar sheets. And this is a new parasite that we found. It's endemic in ring seals in the Arctic, and we found it causing a mass mortality event in gray seals, which are pinnipeds of the North Atlantic. And in fact, in March 2012, 406 animals, newly weaned animals with good body condition, died of a necrotizing hepatitis. And when we went in and did the molecular PCR on these animals, we identified the signature was of that parasite that is infecting ring seals. So actually, this is a first for me as a molecular parasitologist of identifying a parasite that's been liberated from the Arctic to move south. And one has to think about pathogen dynamic. If we think about the Black Death, so when Yersinia pestis was introduced to Europe, it had an entire susceptible population. And as we know, what the result of that was that one-third of the human population died until herd immunity was acquired. And this is a similar sort of effect. And is this the tip of the iceberg? Because this is a pathogen that's moved from the north to the south, and it's caused this mass mortality. But just go back to the first parasite, Toxoplasma. Now, this is an important parasite because it's the leading cause of infectious blindness globally in people. It's an AIDS-defining organism, and a lot of pregnant women know about it when they visit the doctor, and the doctor says, don't change your kitty litter. This is a parasite that's secreted by cats. So what's it doing in the Arctic, and why is it in the beluga? And that's what we're starting to try to investigate. How did it get there?
Michael Grigg from the National Institute of Energy and Infectious Diseases, Bethesda, Maryland, wondering how Toxo got from the cat litter box to the Arctic. Before him, Sue Moore from NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in Seattle, on the thaw, consequences of climate change, speaking at the AAAS in Chicago.